This meeting is being recorded.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest Open Door, Open City podcast. I'm Karina Robinson, co-director of the Inclusion Initiative at the London School of Economics with my colleague, Professor Grace Lawden. Our research centre uses behavioural science and data to help create inclusive cultures in business. Do follow us on Twitter at LSE_TII or sign up to our newsletter, all of which will be on the chat. Directions on how to do that on the chat and the fact that this event will be recorded, and please pose your questions also on the chat. Now, we're very lucky to have with us as our guest Sheldon Mills, who heads up competition and consumers at the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority, the regulator of a great part of the financial sector. He is also chair of Stonewall and its longest standing trustee. We're going to talk inclusion, culture, Russia and crypto, and whatever else comes up. Sheldon, a big welcome to Open Door, Open City.
Karina, thank you very much for having me. I look forward to an interesting conversation.
Now, Sheldon, you're such a respected competition lawyer. You've worked at the Competition and Markets Authority. You've also worked at the FCA for quite a few years. And the question has got to arise, why aren't you at a magic circle law firm earning squillions, you know, the Freshfield slaughter in May? Why are you still at the FCA?
Well, I mean, if they want to hire me, they can come and get me and I'll go and earn the squillions. I mean, I think my career trajectory has been different from some of my peers. So some of my peers, I studied at King's College London, I studied law, and I always wanted to be a competition lawyer. Many of my peers who I studied with are now partners in law firms. I had the opportunity when I was about 8 or 9 years qualified to go into the Office of Fair Trading as Director of Mergers, which is scrutinizing all UK merger activity. I think I was around 34 or 35. And I loved that role. And I loved many aspects of that role. One, looking at mergers is a very interesting activity. Two, leading a team of then around 50 people was something which I enjoyed, that management aspect at scale. And also, doing something which was serving the public and really meant changing things for people, businesses, and the wider economy. And I have enjoyed that. And for this part of my career, I continue to enjoy it. I think when I think about careers, I earn a significant amount more than most of the people that I grew up with and the area from which I come. So for me, I'm pretty comfortable. I do know peers who I studied with for whom my salary would be a pittance and wouldn't support their lives. So it's often personal as to what you need to get by. I think I get by very well and I have a really fruitful and exciting and challenging career.
You mentioned earning more than the people you grew up with. Tell me a bit about your background and how you ended up in the city.
Yeah, so I'm from a place called Ely in Cardiff, which is on the west of Cardiff. I suppose you describe it as a council estate in the past. It's a very proud community. The socioeconomic outcomes for people in that community are mixed. They are improving and they've improved a lot over the years. And the attainment at school is always, a struggle for individuals given your family circumstances and the teachers do their best. It's not like going to a private or independent school. I did well at school, but I only came out with sort of 7 GCSEs. When I got to university, I was shocked to hear that people did 13 GCSEs. I only had 8 on offer for me to do, actually. So to give you a demonstration of the sort of background that I come from. And there was no A-level school, so I went off to a tertiary college about 8 or 9 miles across the city. But I did very well academically, and I had very supportive teachers from around the age of 14. Who saw in me talent that could get somewhere. And I did quite a bit of charity work for a charity called Crime Concern and spoke publicly in the city at the age of 15 with Princess Anne and various things at the NatWest Tower, which is like quite a tall building then. And that gave me confidence to apply to university. And I was lucky enough to get into King's College London and did reasonably well on the law degree, and then looked for a job in the city as a solicitor.
Did you, because you mentioned confidence, and that's been one of the most interesting aspects of inclusion. So much of it is about instilling confidence in people. Just because you look or sound different doesn't mean you don't have a voice. Now, you know, if at 15 you're with Princess Anne giving a speech, that would give you a lot of confidence. But what do we need to do differently in our education system to instill that?
Well, I benefited from a person called Avril Jones. She's still around, actually, in Cardiff. Friends of mine reintroduced me to her a few weeks back. And she came into our school for just a year. And she sought to work with a group of us to do different things in the community. So we had a Save the Tree Society and various things like that. And we had that work, which I did, to charity Crime Concern. And also we started a newspaper within the school. And what she did was, I think she allowed us to see that we could use our skills and talent in a way which could change things. And that gave us confidence, I think, to know that we could play and participate in the world in a different way. And I think, you know, many of the people who were involved in the work with Avril are now teachers and other professionals, and have done quite well, actually, both academically or in their careers. And I think she did give us all, at a good point in our lives, age 13, 14, an eye-opener to a different way of participating in society and in the world of work. And I still thank her for that.
You mentioned that when you were at the OFT, you had about 50 people under you. How many do you have now?
Well, I have, I think, directly around 700 or 800, and then I co-lead the division with Sarah Pritchard, Executive Director of Markets, so together about 1,400.
And how do you create an inclusive culture?
So creating an inclusive culture is, I think, starts from the top, to be honest. It's the tone from the top, and you need to decide that you're going to build a culture around psychological safety, openness, that people can speak up, and that you know, you allow for innovation and people to participate. I think one of the issues of doing that at scale, of course, is that you can't be in every meeting, you can't be in every individual action. So you also need systems and controls in place around various aspects, entry into the organization, promotion opportunities, getting talent to the right sort of assignments, and building that into people's objectives. But by and large, the starting point is that, you know, each voice, each idea, each contribution matters. It's not easy to get right at scale, and, you know, I think there can be challenges, and it's not just about race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation or gender identity. It's actually about how do you respect each individual and their contribution within the workplace, and create the conditions to get the best out of each individual, or maybe the best is the wrong, maybe that's the wrong word, to allow them to participate in a way which allows them to flourish.
There was a recent study in the city, and in it, let me quote from it, more than half of all Black staff worry about being judged by co-workers based on stereotypes. Meanwhile, and this is my gut instinct, but you might have some stonewall data about this, many gay and lesbian workers in the city still haven't dared come out. Now, being gay and Black, obviously not easy in the city. How have you dealt with it? And what advice can you give to others?
I think everybody's circumstance is very different. And I realize that your initial introduction into work is quite important. So one of the things, it goes back to your earlier question, I think the starting point really is employers need to make sure that a gay, Black, cisgendered man feels comfortable the first day they walk into the building. And I've got to say that when I joined Nicholson, Graham & Jones, now K&L Gates, the law firm, I was made to feel very comfortable, even though I was one of only two black individuals in the organization. I was an out gay cisgender man, and I felt very comfortable. There were incidents through that journey, you know, which I've talked about publicly, you know, incidents of what I'd call sort of indirect bias or racism. But I always felt that I could speak to anyone about those things and they would respond and react, and they did. So it's about, you know, so there is something about the workplace responsibility. That's why, you know, and this is important, because racism and certainly in Western societies, and the impact on, let's say, my experience, black people, it's not my issue. I'm black. I haven't done anything wrong for being black. The issue is society and other people, you know. So the starting point for a workplace is, what are you doing to support people who are different? And what culture are you creating? So that's the starting point. And then as an individual, though, obviously you face into that issue. So you can't just ignore it. You have to sadly take ownership and do something about it, in a sense. And I think, you know, it's not always easy. I think there are choices that you can make. If you end up in a position where you feel that the culture around you doesn't work, I now advise people not to sit in that and have that mental health stress and that difficulty. You might sadly either need to invest and work through whether that culture can change and you can be a participant in that change, or find other opportunities. These are sad facts for black, LGBT people, also women as well. And I think there's that. I think there is a real spirit of change, particularly in the financial services sector. So with the Black Lives Matter following the awful death of George Floyd, and also the Me Too campaign in relation to women, there has been real change and genuine commitment from the top to change things for people within industry. And we've done a lot of work at the FCA to look at D&I, and we'll continue with that, because we want to see people actually now take positive action and have meaningful change for people. Just on Stonewall, though, the statistics always shock me, and it's not just Stonewall, other LGBT groups have similar statistics. In 2018, we found that more than a third of LGBT staff, 35%, have hidden that they're LGBT at work for fear of discrimination. I mean, it just, it's for me, it just says there's still work to do. And some of that is personal choice. I think people should be able to remain private about their personal circumstances if they want to. But anecdotally, for those individuals who I've supported on that journey to come out, so to speak, at work in the city, it's usually not a choice. And usually hiding that does cause issues in terms of how they work in the workplace and their own personal lives. And they do want to be open about, you know, what they do on the weekend and who their partner is, but they haven't felt comfortable in that, and they're fearful that that will affect their careers. I'm still surprised that those statistics are so high.
Yeah. Talking about culture in general in the city, the head of the UK audit regulator, Sir John Thompson, he said something rather interesting, which was that a number of company collapses in the UK are linked to, quote, unhealthy cultures. I mean, can you legislate and enforce a decent culture where people can speak out?
I think the starting point on culture is for the leaders of industry and corporate Britain to really come together and work through how you design good corporate cultures with appropriate risk management, appropriate systems and controls, and also, as we've been discussing, appropriate inclusive cultures for people and staff. There's an addition to that, which, in relation to recent initiatives on ESG, there's also, you know, what's your impact on society, the world, climate, etc. So, you know, these four elements. And I agree with Sir John, that there definitely is links between company collapses and the culture. I mean, I agree with that. what we've been doing at the Financial Conduct Authority for many years now is building culture into our supervisory practice. So we supervise around 60,000 firms. We build those into portfolios or firm-based portfolios of some of our largest 100, 200 firms that we regulate, and then wider portfolios on the markets in which they operate, so say banking or insurance or payments. And for all of those, we do regular analyses around the culture. And we look at things around what's the risk management culture, what's the leadership and governance culture within firms, how are people looking at their people and leading their people. And then we look at these aspects and we look in detail at metrics to see whether culture is working both within those firms and some and within the wider market. So we've been looking at culture for quite some time because we do think it's at the heart of, you know, both getting good financial services out to customers and out to businesses, but also preventing major financial crises like we've seen in the past.
And it's like, you know, after the financial crisis, there was a view that obviously regulation had been very light touch and all of a sudden it became much heavier touch and lots of complaints. People might not complain publicly because, you know, in the end you are their regulator. But what was so interesting is, you know, we then have COVID, we have Russia, we have all these things and nobody is saying, oh, the banks are going to go bust. Or even the less regulated firms, none of them. So regulation, you know, I'm sure some things have been slightly wrong, you know, because of it. But overall, you don't get plaudits, do you, for having done a good job when nothing bad happens?
Well, I mean, a lot of the solvency and prudential aspects of regulation is for the Bank of England and the Prudential Regulation Authority. And I think they, you know, plus us, post the financial crisis and internationally have done a huge amount of work to tackle some of the risks which flowed from that financial crisis. I do think there's an open question around, you know, whether or not approaches that we take as regulators do put certain burdens on firms in terms of how they might use their capital, etc. And that might have impacts potentially on innovation, competitiveness and growth. And I think those are important questions that you regularly need to visit and address and either improve or change your regulatory approach. But I think you are right that we have been now through major external shocks and events to the financial system and, you know, touch wood, we haven't yet seen a similar crisis to the last financial crisis. Now, that doesn't mean that might not occur in the future. And it could be a different form of facts that produce that. And I think one of the things which people do complain about is that it will be things like, oh, well, we've done separation of wholesale and retail. We've done, you know, Solvency II and insurance. Now you want to look at operational resilience. Now you want to improve our conduct with consumers. Now you want to do this. And of course, some of that is to look out for the issues that might come forward in the future. I think one of the aspects of the financial crisis is that it's made the regulatory system internationally to look dynamically at the future events, which might cause the next one. And of course, because those things haven't actually come to pass, you know, people might have a view that, wait a minute, you're being far too safe and secure at things which haven't happened. So we always, you know, are on that line of how far do you regulate, how far do you secure the system for the future in order to make things safe. Primarily, at the heart of financial regulation is a safe and sound financial system. I mean, it's the bedrock of the economy and society. When it goes wrong, you know, the effects are really damaging for everyday lives and business. So, you know, that's at the heart of what we do, but we still need to ensure that there's innovation, growth, and all of those things within the system as well.
Going to one of the points you made about operational resilience, where, you know, you have been, you know, demanding more of firms. What, it just seems to me that, just by the luck of the gods, we haven't had our system go kaput. Because if you talk to some of the people in the security services, they say, well, you know, whether it's Russian, Iranian, mafia groups, whatever, they know that they can only go so far in taking down various systems or various companies. But if they go too far, then they're going to have all the MI6, et cetera, on their back. And that's not how far they want to go. But it just seems to me that how do you prepare, for example, why haven't, you know, we have Russia, Ukraine, why haven't the Russian trolls been much more successful with closing down, I don't know, Bank of, you know, NatWest or the London Stock Exchange? Why? And what are you doing, you know, in your role of the regulator to help firms prepare for these sort of attacks?
Well, I mean, we worked on a piece of operational resilience work with our major firms and with the financial services industry starting a number of years ago and leading into final rules on op resilience just last year in March. And that was jointly with the Bank of England and the PRA. And at the heart of that is that firms need to ensure that they understand all of the important business services that they have, you know, the critical business operations. So for a bank, it might be ensuring that your system of moving money around is still working, or the, or for a credit card company that, you know, that the you can still pay at the till, et cetera, with your credit card. All of these things, you know, if they go down at scale, they can threaten confidence in the viability of parts of the financial services industry. So firms have plans in place to deal with that. In terms of cyber, they also have to look after their own cyber resilience. And that is at the heart, not just for firms, it also is for us as regulators and for government. Everyone is for the LS London Stock, you know, for the LSE, London School of Economics. Everyone has to have a cyber resilience policy. And that has to be heightened now, given the war in Ukraine. And I think one of the reasons possibly that we haven't seen any killer blow on any significant institution in the UK so far is that obviously government itself and the security agencies and also many of the cyber parts of government are clearly working very closely with us and other regulators and then informing very quickly major firms and organisations and important institutions as to threats, critical threats, and supporting them in responding to those. So I think we have worked, it goes to the point I was making earlier. You know, we didn't know we were going to end up in a major conflict in Europe with an aggressor who might try to hit through cyber certain parts of our system. But we did already know that, you know, certain nation actors already around, you know, sometimes do certain things. And you see that coming through the system. So we've been preparing for that for some time. And it, you know, it's a salutary lesson that you do have to continue to think about your defences.
There's another major issue which will affect consumers. I mean, you are consumers in competition. So focusing on consumers, cryptocurrency. You know, the government came up with this great idea that we are going to be a center of innovation for cryptocurrency. But then I hear from entrepreneurs in that space, the FCA, and one of them actually came out and said, you know, that before working in a traditional financial institution, they had been fans of the FCA, but they found the FCA was very worried about cryptocurrencies and had even suggested to one of them that they actually move abroad and make their headquarters abroad. So you have these different stakeholders, the government saying we need to be a center, the entrepreneurs saying we need less regulation so that we stay here, the consumers buying up all sorts of cryptocurrencies and a lot of the time not having the slightest idea of what they're doing. No safeguards whatsoever. In fact, there was a firm just the other day where 180 million just disappeared on the back of what might actually be called a legal emptying of the wallet. So what are you doing on the cryptocurrency front as a regulator?
So look, I mean, you know, we welcome the government's you know, approach in terms of cryptocurrency and what they're thinking about there. And I think the reason why we welcome it is at the heart of it is a recognition that cryptocurrency is becoming something that many individuals are participating in, and also parts of the financial system responding to their clients and responding to the activity are starting to engage in as well. And when that happens, from a risk, sound and stability viewpoint, as well as from a consumer conduct risk perspective, it is important to think about whether or not you want to bring that activity into the regulatory perimeter and it be regulated. And I think if you do bring that activity in the regulatory perimeter and it's regulated, and you have a principle potentially of, you know, largely same type of outcomes or conduct, same types of regulation, there might be exceptions for certain aspects of crypto and stable coins, then that will help deal with some of the issues that you're seeing and you're talking about there. Both issues of our understanding of cryptocurrency, crypto firms at the gateway when they come for authorization. Currently, we only have the ability to regulate them for anti-money laundering and those sort of activities, not for the full suite of normal regulation. For their understanding of us and our rules, often when we see entrepreneurial firms which might not necessarily have worked in financial services, they don't necessarily understand some of the risks of their activity for consumers or businesses and are more focused on the innovation and delivering their service. You know, regulation is important to teach and educate those firms in relation to that. And of course, there'll be frictions as you go through that process. And then in terms of the consumer area, we've been quite clear with consumers, and we think this is right, that investing in crypto is not yet the same as investing in a fund, a managed fund, etc. The risks are greater. So it would be the equivalent, you know, if you go and invest your pension, they say, are you high risk or are you low risk? This is definitely at the number 10 on the 1 to 10 scale, and it might be beyond that. And we think where people are investing, where people are putting their money, and it's their last £50 or their last £100 or the last £200, £300, £400, In the context of a cost of living crisis and the challenges that we know are coming through for the economy, they might want to think about whether their, you know, money might be better put in some other sort of vehicle. And we're open and honest about that, because obviously it's important for the whole of society that people manage their money well. Now, that doesn't mean if you've got £10,000, £20,000 to spare and you want to put 5% of that on crypto, that's an issue. I mean, you know, it's up to you, but you know, if you're putting your last savings for the washing machine or whatever into crypto or any other high risk or speculative investment or activity, then we think it's important for us to note to people that you might not get that money back if you need it. And I think that's important. Positively though, about crypto, you know, there are many opportunities from blockchain technology, DLT, and other forms of technology that can go into, you know, harnessing efficiency through payments, through exchange, through making contracts, legal contracts, and other types of contracts. And we do want to harness that. So shortly, we'll be doing a crypto sprint in the FCA. We're inviting about 150 crypto people involved in the crypto space, firms and other people, to go on a sprint and understand how crypto works with regulation. So we're actively going out trying to embrace that innovation.
Understand. What do you mean by a sprint?
A sprint is basically, it's like a tech sprint. So you come in, you get a group of people into the same place, you put them into different groups around certain questions. So it might be, how best can you drive safety for consumers whilst, you know, selling cryptocurrency? And then you get people working through the flow of how that works and the pain points, etc. So it's, you're not running, but it's a quick day or couple of days to try and, you know, take problem questions work through them and see if you can come through with some solutions, and bringing a wide range of actors together to do that. So we're doing that in the next couple of weeks or months, actually, which I think demonstrates that at the end of the day, whilst we think there are challenges with the regulation, we want to embrace the innovation which is coming through.
Yeah. At a more basic level, you know, when we talk about the consumer, one of the sort of campaigns you as head of consumers has been about trying to make people understand that they need to save for their pensions and invest. And yet, you know, we're living in a gig economy. As you said, we've got terrible inflation. We've had the pandemic. And any way you look at it, given how long we're all living, and this is not just, you know, a British problem. This is a problem throughout the West and more than the West. We're not saving enough. I mean, is there any way to sort of, you know, get this up to speed?
So, I mean, I think that the starting point has been the excellent, you know, policy of successive governments on auto-enrollment. So, you know, that overnight has taken so many people into a pensions savings journey, which weren't there before. What is difficult with pensions and saving for retirement is that actually the amount that you need to save now in order to get even a modest retirement, even to get to you know, what is seen as the annual minimum annual wage, is quite significant. And you know, there are lots of studies which show that many of us are not saving to meet that. And you know, obviously the issues with social care and, you know, lives are extended, but your ability to participate in life and the costs of care also go up. So our role, you know, we do not have a formal education role for consumers. That is for the Money Advice and Pension Service. But we do think that that, you know, we indirectly need to ensure that people do understand some of the choices that they have to make in terms of having a healthy financial life. So we're happy to partner with people and also ourselves to put those messages across. What we've also tried to do through firms, as our role is through firms, to help them to expand their activity and expand the healthy choices that people can make with their financial lives, is, and we have been said that we might be over-regulating here a bit, but what we've tried to get firms to do, how can you simplify the propositions that you have for you know, the everyday consumer, so that you can provide packaged products which are based on investments as well as pensions, so that people can regularly put money away in order to supplement their auto enrollment reasonably safely with a reasonable prospect of a decent return at the end of it, as opposed to, I suppose, to go back to the crypto example, but also to go back to certain more high risk investments and more speculative investments, to promote, you know, significantly speculative things to everyday consumers, where some of them, you know, might turn into, might benefit from them, a very small few, but others will lose potentially quite a bit of money, and also place a burden on the financial services compensation scheme in terms of redress and compensation when things go wrong in terms of mis-selling. So getting that balance right through firms of the products and services that you know, they're entitled to commercially and freely offer, is something that we, working with partners such as the pensions regulator, have been working on.
Yeah, it's an ongoing battle, really, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, there is something in our objectives at the FCA, which we don't really focus on very much, which is that under our consumer objective, it also says that we need to balance what we ask firms to do with what consumers themselves must take individual responsibility for. Mm. And those objectives are obviously set by Parliament. And I do think how I interpret that is that there is a need for regulators like us and also firms to educate people to make effective choices, so they can effectively take responsibility for that journey. And auto-enrollment is part of that, but there's more to do to encourage people to supplement and do more to look after themselves in later life. But it's not easy. We all know that the last thing we want to attend to when we finish on a Friday is to think about, you know, what our financial health is, and sort of sort out those papers and work out where we want to.
I'm so glad somebody like you, Sheldon, is actually admitting that.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's human behaviour. So it's not easy, right? So it's almost, you know, the government is looking at this, and, you know, I welcome the pensions minister looking at this, you know, looking at a midlife MOT. So when can we get points and use service providers that that get your attention? So it might be, you know, it might be at the doctor's surgery that your doctor or the receptionist says, have you thought about your financial services as well? Here we can look at, you know, we can do your blood pressure and go through this at the same time. Done, off you go. That's a wilder idea. But I mean, I think, how do you get the attention of people at the right time so they can focus on something and then move on with their lives? It doesn't take much attention if you've got the right provider providing you with the right support through that journey.
Yeah. Getting back to competition, your other responsibility, we're living in a world where, you know, competition law, when you started in it and as to where it is now, I look and I think competition law is absolutely useless. Okay, look at the oligopolies like Amazon, Google, Facebook. Competition in digital markets is different. And how does the law need to adjust so that it's less toothless?
So I think there are different aspects to it. And we have to think about what competition law is and what are the limits of it. So I think there are aspects to prevent oligopolies from coming about, so merger control. And I think there are changes which the CMA has been undertaking in relation to merger control to look more at what you would call the dynamic effects in markets. So rather than necessarily looking at whether a particular product has revenue now, thinking about how it could be important in the future. So that's something, you know, merger control is an aspect which you can look at. Then looking at antitrust investigations. So when you look at abusive dominance or when you look at price fixing and those sort of things, those can be more difficult to deal with some of the issues that the big tech raise. That said, you know, Google was found to have abused its position in search by favoring its own shopping comparison service in its search results. And then it was fined $2.42 billion. That was the EC did that. In the UK, the CMA is looking at the Google privacy sandbox, looking at third-party cookies to ensure they don't reduce competition. And both the UK and the EC are looking at the App Store of Apple. So people are looking at that. However, we've been discussing for most of this conversation the regulatory aspects of my career and what I've been doing. And now we're discussing competition. Competition is about looking at activity which is happening now. There's another part of the competition space which has been quite developed in the UK over decades. You remember the Markets and Monopolies Commission and then the Competition Commission and now the CMA. And that's the market study tool. So looking at a whole market and thinking about the competition in it and whether you can look at things. That tool, I think, is a very good one that can be used to good effect in relation to big tech as a whole. The final thing is that the government itself is looking at powers that it will give to the CMA to look at firms with significant market status in digital. And that should allow the CMA, depending on how it goes through Parliament, to have more of a qua regulatory role in relation to certain aspects of big tech. And I think that probably, plus the online harm powers, which DCMS is looking at, starts to give you a suite of potential powers to look at some of the potential harms that flow from some of these firms. Finally, and I will say this, there are lots of issues with big tech and with these firms, and they are, you know, posing, you know, a range of issues for society. But remember, they only have that power because we use them. And we significantly use them. And we use them because they're more efficient, they connect us more to things, they allow for greater choice, etc., and various other factors. So I think there's a wider conversation in society about what do we want from these service providers and how do we wish to engage with them? And you know, sometimes any form of regulation or competition can't, you know, make people, you know, do things in a particular way. I mean, the market is what it is and it provides. But, you know, I do think that basically a few more powers will be needed to tackle these firms as we move forward in the future.
Going back to diversity and inclusion, the government was going to have a big conference this summer, an LGBT conference called Safe to Be Me. It was going to be one of those things where we were coming out, if you will, as a nation that embraces diversity. Organizations from all over the world. It was going to be a huge celebration. And what happens? There are all sorts of issues with conversion therapy. And the government actually turned round to give it credit and said, well, actually, we're against conversion therapy, where it hadn't before. And yet, for some reason, it left the law on conversion therapy for transgender individuals. And at this point, obviously, about 100 organizations pulled out of the conference. The conference has been canceled. I didn't quite understand why it's not, you know, it wasn't really a headline issue in the press, but I thought it was a very shameful moment for us as a country. And I failed to understand what is the reasoning behind it. And what is your view about the whole issue?
Yeah, so I mean, I suppose I'll speak in my role as chair of Stonewall, and we you know, clearly were going to participate in the Safe to Me conference, and we're very much looking forward to it. You know, bringing together all of the LGBT organisations and individuals across the world, you know, post pandemic was, you know, a really exciting thing to look forward to, and you know, I applaud the government in seeking to develop that conference and the work of Lord Herbert and others to bring it together. I think it is disappointing that the ban on conversion therapy, which was promised by previous governments, both for LGB and for T people, so you know, gay and trans people, that did not move forward. And you know, at the start, it was going to be pulled for both LGB and T people. That was the rumor. And then there was a turnaround, and it was going to go forward for LGB people, the ban, and not for T. And I think one of the challenges for me, and is that at the heart of this is people, and there are people who are suffering significantly. And they are in pain. And transgender people are currently a little bit being demonized. They're not enemies of, you know, of everyday people. They're not enemies of cisgendered women. They are people going about their lives and seeking to contribute to society, which is what we've been discussing throughout this conversation. And to not understand that because there may be actors who are confused about who they are or not believe that they should, you know, exist, and that there might be mechanisms effectively to change their existence, and not to enshrine in law the ability to protect them from that, I think is unfair. There are obviously complex challenges around the medical transition, both for young adults and children and others. You know, those are complexities. Those are for medical professionals, both psychological professionals and others. And those all came out and supported a ban on conversion therapy. And there was a big debate and discussion about whether a ban would impact their work with individuals as they go through those processes. And it was felt that a ban could still work and allow people to carry on with their medical practice. So all of the evidence supported that a ban was completely workable. And I think as that was there, with great regret that that many organizations pulled out of the conference, you know, with great regret. However, I am positive because, you know, many of the polls that one does, YouGov polls and various things, shows that, you know, a high proportion of the population is very supportive of transgender people, you know, is not bothered, you know, just as we all want to, in the face of a cost of living crisis and the war in Ukraine, Russia, just want people to be able to get on with their lives and be the welcoming and open and liberal society that is one of the reasons why, you know, I love, you know, being a British national.
Yeah. No, it's a great, great pity. Now, let me move on to questions. There's one, because I didn't actually ask you, because, you know, the FCA just set positive diversity targets for listed companies. Now, the question here is from, in fact, Professor Grace Lorden. If companies cannot meet them, they need to explain why not. Do you think that these targets will work without penalty? Would you have liked to see hard penalties for large firms that do not make change within the 3-year window before the review?
So I think, I mean, we obviously did discuss whether or not these would be mandatory, or we didn't discuss actually whether there would be penalties, because we didn't think that they would be mandatory. I mean, I think these are very supportive of the FTSE Women Leaders, formerly Hampton Alexander, approach. And they, when a regulator says that as part of its culture work and its culture regulation for firms, and wants to see a different approach in its regulated firms and also listed companies, because we regulate the stock exchanges effectively, wants to see a different approach. And that's internationally recognized, with NASDAQ and others doing the same, supported by the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, then that's a significant signal that change is needed and needs to be accelerated. And I think at this stage, we think that's a sufficient move. I think if we don't see change, then we will have to review and revisit. I would expect, though, that we will continue to see change. The area where, if I'm being very frank, where I still think there's, you know, well, there's work to do on women for sure, and I've discussed that publicly, but the bit which doesn't actually get much coverage goes right back to the start of this conversation, is for people of color. We got no coverage when we put this thing out. And, you know, I personally think, you know, we want to get to a stage where we're even more ambitious on people of color. At the moment, we just say, you know, one person of color on the board effectively. And yeah, and okay, you know, that might bring diversity, but there's lots of different types of people of color. And we know that there are lots of people of color, particularly Black individuals, who don't get any, you know, very much participation in boards and in some of the senior executive roles. So I would hope in the future, and actually a lot of people disagree with me on this, but I would hope in the future that we get more ambitious about other elements of diversity as well. But where I'm positive on this is for women. It is a very strong statement that we as a regulator now expect people to redress the imbalance between men and women in the boardroom.
I'm glad, by the way, you said you're expressing an opinion that a lot of people disagree with. Yeah. I mean, it's good that a regulator is allowed to have his own opinions.
Yes, I am. I think I should be allowed to have my own opinions, absolutely. And I think that's how you get change effectively. I mean, you know, it's sort of, and that's why in one sense you mandating this doesn't quite make sense to me, because if I mandate one person of color on the board, you'll only have one person of color on the board. It won't necessarily be in an executive role, and that's it. Well, that's not right. So I think the debate on having mandatory approaches needs to be taken in the context of the wider range of diversity that we're seeking to achieve in society and how best to take that forward.
Another question from, I think it's Yolanda. What do you think organisations can do to better support people with less visible diverse characteristics, e.g. sexual LGBTQ plus employees who do not wish to disclose their identity? Do you think organisations should be responsible for educating employees on how to be an ally, or should that be the responsibility of the individual? And then the last part of her question is, what do you think organisations can do to better support people with less visible diverse characteristics?
So I think on the ally, I mean, it's pretty standard practice for most, large global companies to have network groups and have programmes of allyship. And I think, I often think that that should be left open in those companies to the marketplace, in the sense, what are people interested in? What do they want to get involved in? What do they want to put their time to? I think for senior leaders, sometimes that you can have much more structured approaches. So for board members, executives and senior leaders, it's quite clear that you want to ensure that there's a sponsor of each network. You want to ensure that there's an ally person for each sort of area of diversity, so that there is somebody thinking carefully about the leader, about the organization's approach to certain aspects. So I think you can be more structured in relation to that. And you should be, because that shows the tone from the top. In terms of non-visible characteristics, so I think the area of diversity, equity and inclusion that isn't given much noise is around neurodiversity or around other aspects of mental health or non-physical disability, hidden disabilities. And I think there are ways around ensuring that they come to the fore. So it is, I really like the fact that every week there's another week about something. I think just last week or the week before, there was a week around autism, and we had some event at the FCA. Some people complain about this, that they get diversity fatigue. I learn something every year from every single event and every story that I hear. And implicitly or directly, that will impact how I treat people the next time I meet, a group of individuals. And it's that constant journey of effectively allyship or understanding in the workplace that I think can really help make places safe. In terms of directly for those hidden aspects of people, you need to adopt. So this form of communication, I think, is people thinks it's positive for introverts, for want of a better word. I personally don't think necessarily that it is, because there are different types of people. Some people will come in this form of communication, yet they will listen, but they will never speak in this form of communication, whereas they might speak in a one-to-one, face-to-face, or in a different type of communication, or find. So I think you always have to challenge yourself on what are the best fora in order to bring voice for different types of people. That's complex, but we know from the studies that level of inquiry, that level of diversity, challenge of self, etc., and that level of exposure to different ways of thinking and doing can have benefits in terms of innovation, creativity, and performance within the workplace. We know that. We also know that going identikit culture or forcing people to behave in exactly the same way, even if they're different, can have really, pernicious outcomes in certain settings or certain types of firms. So I think it's important that we still work to reveal those characteristics and find spaces that they can best work.
Diversity inclusion is it's so complex, and that's why we set up the inclusion initiative at the LSE. It's a lot of the firms need help in some way, and I find there's also For some of the people, they're scared of asking questions for fear of offending. And I think that's something that we need to deal with it so that people can feel free, ask your question, and we'll help answer it and to move this all forward. Sheldon, we've run out of time, sadly, and I haven't asked you what keeps you so young or what keeps you awake at night, but that is going to have to be for the next one. So thank you very, very much for being with us. And to the audience, thank you for your questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to them all. The next Open Door, Open City will be with Julia Hoggett, who is the CEO of the London Stock Exchange, great campaigner for LGBT plus rights. She's also turning the Stock Exchange into a very different animal to what it was before. And she definitely has another challenging job, just like Sheldon, in trying to compete with the US and the vast pools of money over there. But she'll be telling us all about it. Thank you all, and thank you above all to Sheldon.
Thank you, Karina. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.